Today's video is sponsored by Bespoke Funding. Now, Bespoke do have a September competition, which I highly recommend everyone getting involved and checking out. There's a lot of prizes on offer. You just need to simply go onto their website, make an account, and take part. I'm going to be getting involved. I hope you're all going to get involved as well. It's going to be great. Let's get to the video. It's a good one. What's going on, everyone? How are we doing? Welcome back to the channel. Today, I am joined with Charlie and Matt. It's early on a Friday morning. I know you've been busy this week. For the audience, if they're not, you know, aware of who you guys are, do you want to give us just a sort of like a top-down aerial view of, yeah, who are you, what are you about?
We are Westwood Associates, the two of us. We are an FXCFD investment fund. We manage capital on behalf of high net worth individuals, private clients, retail investors, and more recently, family offices. And I mean, that's nice and short and sweet, realistically. Yeah. I mean, our management offices are based in Canary Wharf. More recently, Dubai. We're moving out to Dubai, and then next on our list is Singapore or Hong Kong. We haven't made our minds up yet, but that's short and sweet. I'll let you.
And before Westwater Associates, we were independent traders. We had success as independent traders. We moved to Canary Wharf, and then that's when we had the idea of let's not just manage our own money anymore. Let's now look after actual clients' capital.
No, incredible. It's amazing. And just as well, the office in Canary Wharf, sick. I've been there. It's a nice place to work. So, yeah, no, the boys are doing it right. So how did, obviously you said, you know, independent trading before. If we go back a little bit before that, how did trading come about for you? I know a lot of people always have a similar story, but what sort of got you into the trading world?
To be fair, I think a case for me, it was I always wanted to do something. I didn't know quite what when I was growing up, but it was more of a case of I wanted to do something a bit different. And when trading popped up, that's what I thought really ticked my boxes. So I got into trading around 7 years ago. It was through social media, through that glamorous life that was promoted on there that I'm sure a lot of people can relate to.
Yeah.
Soon realised that weren't going to be, you know, the case. But no, from there I was already in. I loved, you know, learning about, you know, the technical analysis side that we all start with majority of the time. And it really went from there.
Mm. Yeah. No, for me, it sort of runs in the family. My mum was a trader for a Hong Kong bank before she had me. I mean, it's similar to Matt. I mean, I was heavy, like football, sport. And then obviously left college, and I was sort of already in the industry for about 2 years. So going back 6 years now. And then obviously I got more closer with Matt, got more in contact, and one thing led to another. We just sort of went balls deep in the industry, really.
Love that.
We were young, and then fast forward 2 years?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Fast forward 2 years, we made the move in 2020. We took full advantage of the office prices in Wharf. It was always on the cards for us. We knew we wanted to be in and around that area, that network, because it's such an easy place to network. Because obviously you're in a communal office space with other huge firms.
Yeah.
A lot of them were property, but that's completely fine. That weren't an issue for us. A large majority of them were financial institutions and investment firms. So naturally, as us going down there as 17, 18 year olds, turning out every day, it's going to spark a couple of conversations.
You stand out like a sore thumb.
Sore thumb. Especially when you're staying late. When like you're always in, and they're always like these fellas, they're always in your, like, they're never not here.
What are they doing?
So we made the move for that reason. I mean, realistically, we couldn't afford it. We signed a 6 month contract. No, we signed a 6 month contract, and we sort of looked at each other and was like, we're getting thrown out in 6 months time because we can't afford another contract. Let's make sure that
we
stay here, sort of thing.
Yeah,
and we have ever since then. And that was in 2020 July, right? Mm-hmm. July 2020.
COVID. Half rent prices.
Yeah. Oh, mad.
So that was the deciding point.
Mm-hmm. The jump
to just go for it. Yeah. I mean, it was 2,400 a month, which
for somewhere where you are,
weren't too bad. We had we was on 30th floor. The views were way better than what we have now.
Yeah.
It was really, really cheap. And they halved the deposit for us as well.
Yeah,
I'm mad.
So it was tick, tick, tick.
Yeah, you couldn't
we couldn't turn it down.
Take the risk, lose the chance.
Mate. I think we signed another 6 month contract afterwards, didn't we? We stayed there for about a year.
And then we did 6 and 12.
6 and 12. We did 6 and 12. And then they basically chucked everybody out on that on the 30th floor.
Right.
And that's when we obviously thought, well, we might as well go into a bigger office. Things are growing. We can do it.
Yeah.
New areas, new opportunities. And it sort of stopped, spiraled from there, really, didn't it?
Oh, amazing. It's really nice to hear. Did you guys meet prior to, was it social media where you met, or was it just kind of school?
No, me and Charlie have known each other since we were like 12 or 13.
Oh, really? Okay, sick.
We just play football together.
Oh, man.
So we're in the same football team for like three, four years.
Oh, amazing.
There was a slight period after that where I stopped playing football at that team. So it was like 2 years, but we still, you know, connected online with each other. That was there, so we could obviously see what we were doing, similar interests, and it really just went from there. Yeah.
Amazing. Now, that's incredible. So, all right, so to dig into what you do as Westwater Associates, essentially, because that is something that I can imagine a lot of the viewers at home will be very intrigued in, because it's a different side, what I would call the professional side of the industry, right? That was what I would definitely call it. So how does that kind of come about? How did that, this obviously, you know, you said you were trading well yourselves. How did that decision come about to kind of make that jump? And I can only imagine it wasn't a jump that you had. Did you have investors ready to go, or was it just a case of forming it and going
it was
there?
More about talking to friends and family. That period, that December, was we went around just talking to people we knew, people that would trust us as individuals rather than traders.
Yeah.
Because if I go to you as a trader, you're probably not going to invest in me. But as an individual at the time, they trusted me and the faith that I had in this potential company. Mm. So I think in that December, we raised 30,000.
It was 30,000, I remember getting put into the master account, first and foremost. But then the month after, we raised, what, another 70? Another 70 straight after, which was pretty good. But how it basically come about was that 6 month period, or that 12 month period, over that basically 6 month period, we were very, very aggressive with meeting people and having a conversation with them. And we bumped into our now mentor, who we can only sing his praises. He basically put the idea in our heads. And we sort of looked at each other and thought,
why not?
We did have good strategies though for meeting people, didn't we?
We did have really good strategies.
We'd have the office, it was just like commercial office. So you've got offices all around the sides and in the middle, you've got this really nice, like, you know, chill area, if you call it that, right? So a couple hours every day, go out and we just sit on the tables outside, put a couple of the laptops up, do some work, and people start asking
looking over
away,
the shoulder,
talking, conversations get going, and that's how the relationships and the, you know, the networks were built.
Because even we do it now, when we're walking through the office and individuals on his MacBook, I'm always looking
what's he actually up to.
It's naturally very nosy people, so it's a case of, well, as soon as you look, you're sort of like, what are you doing now, mate? Because again, a lot of them were huge property development companies, which is quite nice, because obviously everyone got chucked out on the floor and you all sort of come over to One Canada Square where we're actually based. So they're all like in a close knit. So they've seen us literally come from nothing to literally coming up and up and up and having people work for us. So so that's really realistically how it got started. In January, we had 30K. A month after, we had 100. And it really just started spiraling from there. And the technology that we were introduced to, because we learned, obviously, we were very, very retail. So we were prop firms, our own capital, on a broker, whatever it might be. And obviously, we're sitting down with this individual, and he's telling us, okay, cool, like, what do you do? And we're going, okay, cool, we'll do this, and we'll go, okay, cool. And he started telling us a lot about the behind-the-scenes stuff regarding MT4. Whether it be from what you get from a liquidity provider, or all of the very, I say lucrative, but it's not, because it's there on a plate for people that know it's there on a plate and can get it. Because it's one thing knowing it's there, and it's another thing getting it. Because ultimately, what we found out, the more money you have, the more doors are open. That's sort of where it spiraled to, didn't it?
Yeah, but touching back to the question, the broker who helped us create the fund was the individual who was walking past us and sparked that conversation that day.
Mad.
And we always had this idea that we want to have some form of fund, you know, trading desk. We didn't really know how to structure it correctly. And so we had the conversation with him, and he said, yeah, we can do it. And if you do X, Y, and Z, you can get it up and running. And it really went from there in the space of 3-4 months.
Because for us, we couldn't afford it at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Like, people don't understand how much it actually costs to facilitate something like it. And at the beginning, we really couldn't afford it. So we basically made an agreement that listen, we'll do your social medias, but you give us favor, you pay for, I don't want to pay anything for the facilitation for it. And at the time, we were very, very aggressive in regards to strategies. We've kind of, as we've matured as individuals and matured as a desk, we've sort of come away from the strategies that we were trading at the beginning, especially as our knowledge has increased. Mm-hmm. We've got very more quantitative now. So the strategies have come on leaps and bounds of we've matured as individuals as well. Because not only that, we're not trading for ourselves anymore. We're not trading for a prop firm. We don't realistically have. We have targets, but they're a lot more. They're a lot less aggressive than what you would do on a prop firm. And we have a lot more to play with. And we have to. There's two different trade-offs we've got. Okay, cool. We need to achieve returns, but also we need to manage the business. Mm-hmm. So there's two ends of the spectrum here. We need to look after not only ourselves, but look after clients. We need to look after whether it be risk. We need to look after, because even if risk drops, we're overseen and audited by the liquidity provider. Mm-hmm. So for us, which is a regulated institution by a central bank, so for us, we are heavily, 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 heavily looked at in terms of risk. From a risk aspect, so there's multiple aspects that we sort of need to look after, but yeah, that's how originally we got it running. We was just like, listen, we leveraged our youth sort of thing. It was like, we're very in touch with with social media. You're going for your regulations. Social media is a massive, 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 massive thing for you. You've paid out best part of 7, 8, 9 million for the regulations across the world. You're skin, we're skin. Let's work. There's an opportunity here. You pay for it because you're having to pay for the facilitations anyway, and we will do your social media. So therefore, you haven't got to pay for a marketing team that will save you 10 grand a month. So that's the sort of relationship. That's what got the relationship with the individual going forward, really.
And touching back on the trading strategies, we're not just trading a prop firm prop firm account anymore. It's not just, you know, a glorified demo account. Mm. You have to justify every position you take to a real life human being. So there was a lot more thought that actually went into these positions, and we definitely found it at the start. We were, you know, all lower time frames. Yeah. Like when we first got on, it was very, you know, very lower time frame. But the more capital we had, we found the time frames had to also grow with that capital and go up with the capital.
Because especially like if I speak about my journey individually, I sort of got more in touch with macroeconomics going back a year and a half now. Sort of started dabbling into that. And I found that, well, with the more time I had, the better decisions I could make. And not only that, I got very, very systematic and data-driven. And for me, I found that the lower time frames were very, very, very subjective. So for me, the data and the discrepancies between the data between lower time frame and higher time frame were huge. So for me, I made the jump to higher time frame because I could make less discrepancies and more consistency in the data. From a higher time frame perspective, gives me more time to make better decisions. I can input my macroeconomic knowledge and my macroeconomic edge in general. And then that sort of spiraled from there. And now more recently, over the last 6 months, we've turned very, very quantitative, very, very quantitative, because we've become more in touch with a buy-side community, which basically brings together the largest asset management firms, hedge funds, investment firms, technology, liquidity providers, whatever it might be, the sell side and buy side, they bring them all together. The biggest in Europe, we just got back from a residential in, when was it, July? Mm-hmm. July. So it was a 2-day thing. We stayed over, all put up. It doesn't cost us a penny. They pay for everything. They bring all the buy side community together. Fantastic networking. And we're obviously sitting down as individuals. Again, brilliant conversation start, because we're sitting down in a small group. It's only about 5 a table. There's roughly about, 20, 25 people there, mm-hmm. all from like heads of desk from asset management firms. Heads of desks at FX, central banks, whatever it might be, Swiss National Bank, whatever it might be. And it's a small circle like this, and we're sitting down, and everyone's sort of looking at us like, what are they doing here, sort of thing? Are they part of the marketing team?
Like, wrong place.
Wrong place? Like, are these fellas like, fucking college is that way, mate? So we're sitting down, we're always watching, we're always listening. Like, we're massive for listening. Because again, they're saying, they're having conversations that we have no clue what you're talking about. But then they're asking us the question. We're sort of like, and everyone's sort of gauging, okay, they know a little bit, but they don't know everything. So the more we're going and the more we're listening, we can now string a conversation very comfortably with whether it be a sell side individual from Bloomberg or whether it be from a liquidity. We know what we're talking about. And some people sit back and are like, well, fair enough. Like, I weren't expecting this. But we've seen a trend, but by listening, we've seen a massive trend that a lot of the hedge funds, asset management firms are starting to turn very, very quantitative going forward into obviously the future. So it kind of sparked an idea into my head, especially in regards to looking into it. And a lot of it on the surface, everyone sort of turns around and goes, that's a lot of maths, that's a lot of coding, that's a lot of expressions that I don't realistically know. But for me, it wasn't necessarily about the mathematical equations. It weren't essentially about the coding or anything like that. It was more about the ideology and the methodology behind quantitative systems. So that's what I started out with, and it massively aligned, and realistically one thing went to another, and now we're very heavily quantitative focused from a risk metrics perspective and also a trading strategy perspective, because again, when you're an investor, you can't argue with numbers.
No.
As soon as I put something down in front of you, this is what we've done over the last 2 years in terms of returns, and this is what our strategies do in terms of numbers. You're looking at it and you don't really care who's in front of you after that, because numbers don't lie, and especially if there's a track record it's very hard not to say no.
I think it's quite fair to say we were, on the first event we went to, we were very much out of our depth, but I think
very out of depth.
That situation in being out of our depth, yeah, just allowed us to learn so much about the industry, very much one step further than just your typical retail trader. We learn about the back end, the technology side.
Yeah.
And I think that's what allowed the company to progress quite far.
Yeah, it sounds incredible, that point, just to touch on that, because I think that's something that, you know, a lot of people, whether it's entrepreneurs, whatever they're looking to get into, like you said there, you're out of your depth, but you're able to listen and accept that you're out of depth and potentially put your ego at bay. Because some people can go into those rooms of an ego, right? They're like, we're here, we're the man.
Yeah.
But you went, we're here, we're potentially out of depth, we're going to listen and learn. And now, like you say, you've come on leaps and bounds where you can hold down a conversation with people that would look at you at first glance and be like, maybe they can't. And then be like, damn, these guys don't.
I love that. Right? And some of the faces that people pull and they're like,
what do we always say?
We always do. But like one thing that we had a conversation before we went and was like, we can like do a lot here, because again, like a lot of it, because obviously in this circle, a lot of people come up to us like one-on-one. Because these are like little round tables or whatever, and we're having like a one-on-one conversation with an individual. And some of these individuals are like 45, 50 years old. So naturally, you got to think about it from our perspective. In our minds, we're thinking this individual's will likely have children our own age as well. So they're not looking at us as a colleague or like on the same level. They're looking at us from like, oh, you're very much like my kid sort of thing.
Yeah.
So like when we're asking questions, they're naturally, they don't see us as competition. Which is a massive advantage for us, because we're like, well, if they don't see us as competition and they're looking at us because we're young or whatever it might be, we can sort of play on that a little bit more.
Let's get them talking. Yeah.
Let's get them talking, because they're going to be quite loose and they're not going to be very tight-fisted with information, because for us, they're looking at us and almost like, oh, you remind me a little bit like my younger one or like whatever it might be, or my son. Or what, you remind me a lot. So they're going to naturally tell us a little bit more than what they would do if they saw us as direct competition sort of thing.
But we always say they look at us in either two ways. They either say they're young, what's the catch?
Mm.
Or they say they're young, oh, they've done good for them. Mm. And it really, really depends on that person's mindset, how they actually view us.
How they perceive you.
We get quite often, don't we? You know the two fellas out of The Big Short?
Yeah, yeah.
Charlie, the Brownfield guys. We get that quite often, don't we?
Okay.
Yeah, we do.
Okay.
We get that quite often.
It's interesting as well, because when you go back to the sort of formation of Westwater, it's really interesting to hear how kind of much you backed yourselves.
Mm.
Obviously, like going and seeing family and friends and you know, trying to accrue this money and essentially, you know, it's always that thing of don't mix kind of business and pleasure and friends, right, and family. But you've done it in a way where you believed yourselves. Where did that kind of like belief come? Because I feel like a lot of people in this day and age now, they do struggle with that kind of backing themselves. And I always say, like, you've got to back yourself more than anyone, right? Because if you don't believe in what you're doing, then no one else is going to believe in it, and it will show. Did anything stand out for you if you look back on that? Like, what really allowed you to go, look, give us the money, we can back it. Did anything...
if you don't mind me jumping in, in my from my perspective, our mentor sat us down about 6 months afterwards, and in my opinion, it was just blind courage, complete blind courage. We didn't realistically know the depth of what we was doing, but we just had complete blind courage. We was like, look, listen, it can go wrong, it can go right. If it goes wrong, we're back to square one. We haven't realistically lost anything. If we hit it off, it's the world's our oyster sort of thing. So in my opinion, it was complete blind courage, to be completely honest with you. But
I think we put ourselves in a position where we couldn't. There wasn't any going so home. True. That wasn't an option for me. It was, we're in Canary Wharf now, and I don't want to be in 6 months' time back in my bedroom as a 19-year-old. Looking at the walls. So it was a case of, we're going to get this work, we're going to find it, how to get it working, and luckily we did.
Amazing. I think that's just a true testament of character that you've got as well, because like you say, having the courage to do that, not many people would take that on, right? So you've done that, you've backed yourself. Did it come again, we spoke about data briefly there, which we'll get into, did it come from that you had data in what you did as a trader, you knew you could trade? Was that an element that helped?
No, not at the beginning
that
at all.
That came later on.
At the beginning, that's why I speak purely of blind faith, and blind courage, to be completely honest with you. At the beginning, it was sort of a case of like, yeah, I've done all right for 6 months, 8 months. It seemed all right. These are the targets that we set ourselves. We've done it over the last 8 months. Surely we can do it going forward. Yeah. And it was completely different. I remember jumping straight on, and we had the conversation. It was completely different, like managing actual people's money who you actually know, and you have to look in here, because again, I've got some of my best friends in obviously Westwater, and I'm going to the gym, I see them every single night, and the sort of feeling that I get, that when I look you in the eye and I've had a bad day, mentally it can take a toll when you're in a red month, especially at the beginning, because we have no liquidity, like from a company perspective, we have no backup plan. We have no pillow to sort of, we need to get this up and running, and we need to be in the green as early as physically possible to be able to manage it from a business perspective, like on the two trade-offs. So for us, I mean, as soon as the 30K was all right, as soon as it got to 100, and this is why I'm very heavy on the transition from lower time frame to higher time frame. Once it got to 100K, shit hit the bed. Like, it was tough, like really, really, really tough. And then we was like, okay, cool. This is why we was almost like, we're going to make this work sort of thing. Let's sit down, let's crack on. And that's why we was doing a lot of overnights
At that stage, when we hit that 100K, that's when we had that business structure change. Initially, in that opening 1 to 2 months, we were running on what we now look at as very unprofessional, but we were actually doing a profit split. And it's something we'll never, ever go back to. But we structured, the structure change was then from profit split to what was more professional, it's called cycles. So a client is now locked in for a cycle with a forecast target. So it's not a guaranteed target, because it's
of course
an investment. Yes. You're trading at the end of the day. It's not, you know, a bank account. But that way the client will roughly know what he can expect, rather than whatever profit's on the table, you get a cut of. And that's where that structure definitely works a lot better for us.
And we needed to make that transition as well, because from a technology and trading perspective, it wasn't like doing it off of a profit split, where like originally we were like, okay, cool, clients can withdraw whenever they want. All you got to do is just ring us up, give us 2 week notice, we'll process the withdrawal. It's not an issue at all. But then when we got more in tune with the technology and more in tune with the risk, we was like, that's not feasible, because now we're cutting into our profits. So we was like, we need to make the transition from a psychological perspective to cycles. Okay, cool. We do a 6 month or 12 month cycle. We need to make it from a psychological perspective, but we also need to make the change for a business and trading perspective, a risk metrics perspective. Because the issue that we would find, we spotted it very, very early, that the massive, massive, massive issue that we'll come face to face with in the future is, let's say, for example, our AUM is 100K. And 80K of that is one client. That client turns around in 2 weeks ago and tells me, oh yeah, by the way, I'm pulling it because I'm buying a house, for example. Whatever it might be, I'm buying a house. But now I've got trades, not only, like, look, listen, at the time it was intraday or whatever it might be, or intra-week or whatever it might be in MT4, but on the back end, I've got trades running. So for me in the hedging facilities, if I've got trades running and someone pulls their liquidity, well, now I'm overexposed and over leveraged and my margin's completely just been et up because I've had to process the liquidity. And now what's happened? Well, I've been completely liquidated and now I've got liquidity provider on my ass talking about risk. And I'm like, well, it's not my issue. I had to process legally. I have to process the client. Like, I can't say no to a client when he wants to withdraw. Legally, we have no grounds unless we have a legal contract in place, which we do. So for us, we were like, well, listen, to protect that, and not only that, that eats into our margins. Because if a client pulls the trade too early, if I have to close the trade too early, well, now you're eating into my margins. Yeah. So it was a case of, okay, cool, let's transition to 6 and 12, because then what we can do is when we know a client's maturing at a certain date, well, we can either A, have the liquidity there, or B, we can position ourselves in a case of, well, actually pulling trades off to basically cover the client. But yeah, no, that's from a business perspective and a trading perspective. But once we got that nailed down, it was just complete.
Made life a lot more easy.
Don't get me wrong, we've hit bumps along the way.
Of course, yeah.
But since then, like,
we always said right now that the risk we were taking at the start, we've never taken now.
Never again.
Okay. Because at the very start, it was, even though the business wasn't worth much, it could sacrifice the whole business.
Yeah.
Would we ever take a risk right now on that same level?
No way.
Never.
Not after what you've built, what you've been through, lessons you've learned.
Never. Never again.
Right. So I respect that. So when you talk about lower time frame, are we talking like 1 minute, 5 minute kind of stuff?
30 seconds.
30 seconds, yeah, I've been there. Yeah, it's fine. Vibes.
Yeah, I'm glad
you're a lot of people there are going to be like, yeah, same. If you're in the chat watching live, you'll probably light the chat up if you've traded the seconds, because I know you have. When you say high time frame now, are we more like 15, 1 hour, 4 hour daily?
One hour, four hour.
And then like, are you having like a higher time frame? Weekly, daily, looking on the charts?
Well, 4 hour one. Depends on, because we run four strategies.
Right, okay.
Four alphas. One's an alpha, four strategies, because a lot of people interpret alpha differently. If you're from a quantitative background, you're thinking that's an algorithm. We don't run any algorithms, so just to clarify. No algorithms at all. Okay. So on the raw face of things, we run four strategies, but then also we have the hedging facilities, which we have to manage as well, because there's different tweaks of settings. Like, different banks will have different settings on a hedging facility, and we have different settings on.
So the front end is manual, back end is hybrid.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is essentially hybrid, yeah. Because every action that we will have on the front end has a counteraction on the back end.
Interesting.
But the back won't interfere with the front.
Right.
So whatever we do in MT4, if open a close or close a trade, it will do something in the back end. So that's basically how the structure is. But everything's built off 1 hour and 4 hour.
How do you find managing kind of four different systems? Do you sort of take two each, or do you just four each?
The trade desk definitely helps.
Yeah. It does help. I mean, everything 4 hour is pretty easy to manage.
Yeah.
That's exactly why we wanted to do a H4, because it gives us more time to execute.
More time
if everything's done off, you know, the M3 or the M5, it's not going to be.
You've got to make that decision critically within the minute, because then you've missed it, it's pushing, you're getting a bad feel, you're getting a bigger stop, it's chaos, right? Well, it's like you say, 4 hour, you've got a long period to go, is this the right position, entry, play around with it like that. No, it's interesting.
And the majority strategies are like that.
Yeah, I'm starting to realize this more as I'm growing and maturing as a trader as well, and having different conversations. I'm realizing that a lot of people that trade large capital, they're not trying to do that on the 1 minute and stuff, because they're just like, you know, if you said to an investor, for example, I'm having a 2 pip stop with your 100 grand, they're going to be like, not sure I think about that. You know, like,
not only that, I found as my knowledge has increased as well, I find that a lot of people that trade lower time frame don't actually understand why they're trading lower time frame. You're going to try and justify it based off your own knowledge, but your knowledge is based off what someone's told you, not what you actually know is the truth. That's what we found a lot of people. That's why we don't get involved in a lot of bits and pieces.
The best way, mate, stay out.
You're right. You're right because someone's told you that you're right, or someone's told you that information.
They don't know
you
the logic behind it. You don't know the logic. Ideologies.
You don't
They're
know
just
how.
Trading it because someone else says it works.
Yeah. I can say, okay, cool. What's the FX market? Is it quote driven or order driven?
Yeah.
Nobody will know. You just guess. Or if I throw a third one in there, I'll give you just two wrong answers. You'll pick two out of the two because you'll think it's a 50-50 chance. Yeah. But not a lot of people actually understand why you're doing day trading. No one understands like the methodology behind it, why day trading is there, or why it's more sought after. Or
and then traders will wonder why they don't have an edge.
Yeah.
Because they never really bothered.
I've noticed that myself. People are so interested now in, I don't know, let's say someone brings out an entry model and they're like, oh, I need that because it works for them. They'll implement into the system, don't really understand why they're doing it. No. They look for the pattern, for example, doesn't work. They're like, what the fuck, doesn't work? And it's like, dude, there's a lot more that comes
back
to that.
Back test it on the Sunday and trade it live on the Monday.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where, like, you see a lot of people now on YouTube, you know, showing out these strategies, 100% or 90% win rate, 1-2, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, you get great views, you might help some people, but when they back test it, it might work in a simulated environment. I tweeted about this yesterday, but when it goes live, it's a different ball game, right? Yeah. Like completely
and just
different.
Just because it worked in the history doesn't mean it's going to work.
New data can come, right?
New information's always coming into the market.
Yeah, no, 100%. So no, it's really interesting that you obviously, again, gone higher time frame. And I know a lot of people, I see a lot of people lately now have also, you know, pivoted away from that and they've gone to the higher time and they're seeing a lot more success. And I think I want to touch on this because I know it'd be a great kind of topic. You've mentioned, obviously, we touched prop firms briefly and obviously you don't really have, if you like, set targets. Mm. Obviously, the industry has been crowded with this, you know, if you can't make 8 to 10%, you're not a good trader sort of thing, which again, depends what capital you've got. If you're undercapitalized, £100, 8 to 10% or 3% is not a lot, right? Yeah. But if you're trading a lot of money, 3%, 4% is a lot of money.
Yeah, it is.
So in terms of how you structure things, obviously, how much you want to go into it's completely fine to you, but do you have like not a set target but a benchmark you would try and track yourself against? You kind of compared to like say an S&P, if you're looking at an investor, do you go, right, well, the S&P's done 15%, if we bring you 20 in a year it's good, like do you do things like that? How does it work?
Yeah, we do we run simulations depending on the strategy. So depending on the strategy and the metrics, we'll run a simulation and basically the equity curve over a course of like the time series of how many trades is actually going to be executed on.
Right.
We run a simulation for that with all the risk metrics that we've got in sample data. And then basically we will do an out sample test and then basically we will run that equity curve against the simulation. So basically we will have parameters in regards to what we expect in regards to, because obviously it will take into account all of the ratios that we use, the expectancies, the win rates, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It will generate a certain amount of simulations that we will basically fit our out-of-sample test in a simulation. If we get a strategy that takes 250 trades a year, we will basically tailor the simulation to 250 trades for a yearly projection in simulation. And what we will basically do is we'll monitor that said strategy and that said equity curve. And if we see any sharp turnover, like basically any sharp turnarounds in regards to whether it be sharp ratio or whatever the ratio is or win rate or whatever, and it falls out of that simulation, we're now having the conversation, well, of two things. How can we get out of this strategy cheaply? And where do we go from here? Is it a case of, well, is it seasonality in the strategy? Are we within our max DD or our expected DD? How long is it expected for this drawdown? Is it expected to last? They're the sort of conversations that we will have basically.
That's targets for us, and that's really how we forecast our equity curve. But in terms of for clients, so we operate on two cycles, as we previously mentioned. We have the 6 month and then we have the 12 month. 6 month cycle will target 2% a month for a client, which is realistic. And then for a 12 month cycle, we'll target 3% a month for a client.
Okay. Do you have to, so obviously with the investor client side of things, is it kind of a case of weekly check-in, monthly check-in updates on how they're getting on?
Weekly.
So we check in with them. Accounts are always updated every single Thursday, depending on how the week's performance has gone. And that's when we'll touch base at the trade desk and account managers will get in contact with the clients.
Nice. How have you found, you know, obviously investors as such, when you're updating them, perhaps you've had a negative week, which can happen. Do you find they take that well? Have you ever had an experience? Again, you don't have to mention any names.
No, of course.
Experience with people that maybe don't like the being in the drawdown?
No. Reason being is because we can manage it a lot better from a business perspective.
Okay.
So basically, let's say, for example, we overachieve 1 week or we overachieve 1 month, we can essentially set it aside for a rainy day. That's not an issue at all. Or whether it's a case of, look, listen, we find more often than not the individual is investing in us rather than what actually we can do. And not only that, I mean, let's say, for example, we've had a client for a year. Well, their equity curve is up.
Yeah.
So for us, we will kindly remind them that, listen, it is what it is.
Money.
It's trading. You've made money. It's within forecast. There's nothing you have to worry about. And then next week when it's blue,
Even though it's only, you know, 3% a month, over a year, that's 42% compounded. So your equity curve is still looking very healthy.
Yeah, of course. And in terms of like risk on the other end, because again, it's something that a lot of people, I think, nowadays have kind of lost sight of risk management and how important it is.
Yeah.
Do you have set levels of risk where you, you know, if you go below a certain amount, there's warning flags, or is there anything in place that prevent that?
Yeah, of course. There's two aspects to this. There's the aspect from a business perspective, what we have in place with clients, and obviously I'll let Matt tell you about that. And then obviously we have risk from a strategy perspective. From a strategic perspective, it depends on two things, because a lot of people talk about risk, but not a lot of people know what risk actually is and what it consists of. It depends on two things, intrinsic and extrinsic risk. So that's things like a tail risk event, or whether it might be whether we have to cover it with a specific hedge, raw hedge. This is where the macroeconomic knowledge comes into play, and why it's so you don't have to know it, but in my opinion, knowing it gives you an edge, because let's say, for example, I'm too overweight for a USD long. We've got a meeting coming up, highly anticipated. I feel like I'm on the wrong side of the market, but from a strategic perspective, I can either do two things. I can descale risk, which I don't like doing, or I can cover it with a hedge. Well, how can I go short dollar? Well, you can either look at what's currently anchoring the FX market, whether it be rates, whether it be risk sentiment. So if it's risk sentiment, I can lean more heavily into commodity currencies. So it's the tail end, and I can find quite happily a tail risk hedge for my certain positioning and cover for that meeting. So it depends on either intrinsic risk of said weighting, so whether I'm too over AUD weighted, or extrinsic risk. It depends on them two metrics. But then from
in terms of a percentage from the client's perspective, we always have the agreement with them. In the situation that it hits minus 10%, it hasn't, but we have to have something in place for obvious reasons. The cycle can break, and they can leave the cycle early. So if they're in month 7 of a 12-month cycle, they can leave that at the minus 10%.
Yeah. Amazing, yeah. So you've got breathing room, right? Because like you say, 10%, it's not likely to happen, but you've got to have something. Yeah. And again, I think that just gives a bit of context to people at home. You know, if you're in a couple of percent drawdown, it can happen, and it's quite normal, and not to get too beat up by it because of these drawdown rules.
It's very, very normal,
right?
To be in drawdown.
Yeah, it's very normal.
Every strategy, you'll go on a period, even if it's the best strategy in the world, where you'll lose 3, 4, 5 trades.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's why you've just got to get content with losing in part of this game. If you're looking for that perfection, you can run whatever algorithm you want to still have the losses in them, right?
But during that losing period, that's where everyone's like, okay, I need a new strategy.
Exactly.
I need to change my concepts. I need to buy a new course because they're not satisfied.
Yeah, and I think
it's not green every week.
But that can come from a lot of things, like, you know, the social media side of it. Yeah. Social media can be good, but it can have the real counter effect where you're seeing everybody win, perhaps, and you're like, oh, I'm losing. And I myself, I had a negative July, and I've had a break even August as it stands. Yeah. But I'm at a position where I'm content in my system and myself, where I'm like, this is part of it. But old me would have been like, well, that guy's just posted a chart. You know what?
It logically doesn't make sense. How can every trader on social media win, but 95% of traders lose?
This is because you're seeing the highlight reels, right? You're seeing, like, you see the stats shown about, you know, where someone might spend 50 grand on accounts, they'll get a 55 grand payout, share the 55 grand payout. Mm. They've only made 5K profit. Now, they've still made profit, but arguably you're not seeing the failures, right? And the perception you have of trading is, it can be very skewed. And it's amazing hearing from your standpoint, from what you've built, the capital that you're managing, to say, look, risk's normal. It's like, you know, people need to get that in their head that it's a complete normal thing in this industry. And it's just how you manage risk when you're in the risk, right? It's not going, I'm in 2% drawdown, I'm going to increase my risk to get out quicker. And because that's where, again, it's slippery slope, right? Because if you lose again, you're going further into drawdown. Mm. It's messing with the data projections you've got, because you've run it on probably a sim based on, say, 0.5% risk or 1%. And now you're risking it on 2-3%. It's messing with your numbers, right? So no, it's really incredible to hear that. In terms of, like, obviously growth for you guys and scalability, is it kind of one of those things where capital is constantly scalable, or does it get to a point where you have to start struggling with liquidity and things? Does that get to a point? Because I always hear the thing flown about, you know, once you get sort of past, like, say, 5-10 million, you'll struggle to get positions filled.
No.
Is that a thing?
No, that's not a thing at all. It becomes more prominent when you go above 50 million.
Okay.
But then it all comes down to who you know. And I'll touch on that. When it comes to liquidity, I mean, for us, I mean, we can't take the way we're structured and where we're moving now. We want to transition into a hedge fund.
Right.
So we can take institutional clients. And when we do that, I'll be very disappointed in us if we can't get 150 million by the end of the week. Right. If we wanted over, if we wanted 50 to 150 million, I would be very disappointed in us to not be able to get it by the end of this week. I would be very disappointed in us. So from a liquidity perspective, the world's your oyster, because even if you're a hedge fund and you're looking to get more capital, you can just start acquisition. And that's how a lot of hedge funds transition into asset management. They start acquisitions. From a filling perspective, you're not going to have an issue whether you're using a prime brokerage or whether you're using just a normal brokerage in general. You're not going to have an issue getting filled on a position above below 50 million. But even then, I mean, we've got access to things like FX execution algorithms,
right?
So that will help you get filled in the market. Mm-hmm. And this is why a lot of the strategies and the concepts that we essentially use, or the methodology, should I use, is more centered around FX execution algorithms. Because you look at these, I mean, we've had conversations with heads of desk that push 500 million worth of position, worth of ticket a day.
Oh, wow.
Like, I've seen tickets that are worth 200-400 million per ticket. And that's the type of order that you're going to struggle to get filled.
Our trade desk can take up to 100 million. Mm. So until we hit that 100 million, we'll have to change a couple of things, but it won't be the end of the world.
No, it won't be the end of the world. But yeah, no, that's why obviously when we're sitting down with them, they're like, okay, cool, you don't realistically need anything below 50 million. For us, we need FX. They have different things. They either use FX execution algorithms, or they'll use an algo wheel, and they'll just put the order. There's many different things from a liquidity perspective and from an execution perspective that there's a lot of data, there's a lot of vendors out there from a sell side perspective that will help in regards to that. Whether it's a case if you put a ticket through it electronically or through the phone, it depends on your preference. It depends on how quickly you want to get filled. Because again, a lot of the firms want to get filled very, very quickly. A lot of these FX execution algorithms are passive, or you can get aggressive ones. And obviously you get drawdowns with that. I mean, we've sat down with Deutsche Bank, State Street, UBS, individuals in these firms, and we can edit these FX execution algorithms when we want to come around.
Okay,
that's just when we reach.
We get to that point. And that's why having access to our phone book is
gem.
It came from putting ourselves in that uncomfortable position.
I was going to say, you didn't just, it wasn't like someone 20 oh, guys, you've gone out, grafted your ass off. And like you say, you would sit in that lobby, you would just set up and hope someone would come and speak. And you were willing to engage in the conversation with people, even being at your depth, but you just did it, right? And I think that's something to take from that is, you know, if you've got an idea, if you've got a plan, sometimes you're not going to have everything mapped out. It's a case of just get stuck in, right?
We wouldn't have a business if we didn't talk and create a network.
Yeah.
So it shows having people's skills is important, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, I'm naturally an introvert, so for me, I can have a conversation quite comfortably with someone, but I need to mentally prepare myself for it. So if I haven't got the social barrier, I'll quite happily sit here and not say anything. Well, I'll be very tight-fisted with what I say. Unless it's on trading. If it's on a subject I like, if we're talking about watches, cars, F1, whatever it might be, or something I'm passionate about, golf, whatever it might be, I can quite comfortably have a conversation. If we're sitting here talking about social media, I'll turn off. Don't get me wrong, I have such a large respect for people that are in the industry that do social media. It's such an important aspect and such a big thing that you can leverage. And so many people have done so well out of it. But for me, I know myself as an individual so well. It's not my bag.
Yeah, we know our bread and butter.
I know my bread and butter.
Yeah. You know what you're good at and you know what you're passionate about, right? And that's where you channel your focus. I think sometimes people can get kind of caught wearing too many hats, doing different things.
Yeah,
100%. Way too thin, right? And then like 100%. You say, what you're building could get neglected to build something that, does it have the upside for you? Probably not. 100%. So you have to
Not a lot of people actually go sit at the end of the bed and actually, like, who am I sort of thing. Like, you need to know yourself so well. There's not a lot of people actually know who they are.
No, they don't. A lot of people are hiding behind a false image, a false sense of insecurity. And, you know, I went for a complete rewire of my image and the things that I believed to be true and held on to. And when I really dug into it, I was like, whoa. And it did just feel like it opened up a new paradigm for me. Mm. And I always say to people, you know, just do the inner work on you first. Stop worrying about trying to give valid value to someone or whatever it is. Make sure you're content with you. Focus on you, get yourself, because again, like you say, we're in a day and age now where I do believe there's never been a better time to be a trader.
100%.
Provided you action it, know what you're doing, you can make crazy amounts of money and you can build crazy things. But sometimes people get lost in, oh, but he made more money or he makes more RR or he did
this. The barrier to entry has never been lower.
Oh, dude, I remember when I used to be like, put credit cards in brokers, 500 quid and then follow some guy's signals and blah, I'm going to make it one day. Now you can put 500 quid in a credit card on a prop firm and probably fluke 100K challenge and make 10 grand.
100%.
You know, it's a different world. So I do think that has also brought with it, though, people that are not fit for the industry.
100%.
Because the barrier's so low, right?
100%.
So those signal people are now on prop firms.
Yeah. Something I thought about earlier is obviously you said you've got your strategies, you trade yourselves. At some point you've mentioned, you know, you'd like to pivot into hedge fund when you get to that level. Would that be a case of you would look to onboard, would you onboard different strategies in terms of, can you onboard traders? Can you onboard algorithms? Or would you just keep it what you've got? Would you look to branch out further?
Good question. For us, we... A lot of the, so obviously these communities, like these like exclusive events that only buy side firms can realistically come to, and you've got to have a minimum AUM as well. Well, you've got to reach, you got to obviously facilitate the minimum. That we sit down and we're listening, and some of the biggest issues that some of these biggest asset management firms, hedge funds, investment firms or whatever, the biggest issue that they're currently facing is talent acquisition. Okay. For us, we have the conversation, we're like, well, we've got 5 to 10 people that currently are in the office that work for us. And they're like, keep it like that. Yeah. The more people you bring on, the more rag you have. Because now we sort of go from, okay, cool, we're sitting from a business perspective, we're managing the business, we're also doing heavily on the trading side of things, everything's smooth. And when we start bringing other people into the fold, it's almost a case, well, I need to start managing people.
Yeah.
And yeah, I can delegate from a work perspective, but for us, we've had the conversation again and again and again from individuals that are head of desks at like huge firms that do a lot more volume than us, and they say keep it as small as physically possible.
But that's not saying we won't implement new strategies as we grow, because we can still implement new strategies without actually putting more bodies in the office.
Of course. No, it's really interesting. It's something I've always thought, as you grow and scale, do you need to offset and diversify that capital across different strategies, or is it a case if you can build strategies about, like you say, having someone physically sat there.
Yeah.
So I guess at the same time, you've got to have that person's kind of
level of trust as well.
Yeah, right. Because you've built this from the ground up, and then you go, right, here's, I don't know, 20 mil, you manage it. If they don't know,
of course,
it's going to affect you, right? Because you're going to take the risk of the downside.
It comes back to Westwater and its reputation.
For us, I mean, hiring internally is something that we will do throughout our journey to begin with. You come in doing marketing, for example, it's not the end of the road sort of thing. Like, you're in and around us, you know how we work as a business, you know how we are as individuals, you know what we want, how we want it, and the standard, and you know what we expect sort of thing, being around us from no matter what you're doing. So when it comes from, okay, cool, well, we need to start allocating out to traders, we'll never do it externally. We always say, okay, like, you're here because you're interested, let's sit down and have a conversation sort of thing, because people that are already in and around us will fit in so much easier to a desk, and it works so much more, it makes sense to us completely. Going out externally and putting a job advert out there for a trader.
You're gonna get bombarded.
We're gonna find a lot of people.
Especially if you stick it on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. Especially on Twitter. I mean, like, we get the message all the time, and nobody realistically understands, well, why wouldn't you onboard me? Because I've got this. Yeah. I've got this. I don't care what you've got. I don't care what you do. For me, I don't know you as an individual.
Yeah, it's a lot.
We don't have that relationship.
Even track records are hard.
Yeah.
A lot of traders did 4 or 5 years ago. They won't be consistent traders, but they'll have 15, 20 different broker accounts. Mm.
Okay.
They'll trade for 12-month period. After that 12-month period, they'll try and just get at least one audited track record across.
And then use that to,
leverage a career.
Oh, wow.
Inconsistent on 19 out of the 20 accounts. But that one account, that's the statement they'll get. And then they'll take that forward and try and leverage
that's
off.
That's worrying, isn't it? I guess it's the same with props. People do it with props. They'll buy multiple prop accounts of different people, and they'll try and leverage the props against one another. Yeah. One will work, they'll be like, boom. And Yeah, it's quite scary, because I was going to touch on that. How important would you say a track record is to a trader? But I guess if there's ways around it, I guess you need third-party verification somehow that it's their only way of trading, perhaps.
It's quite hard, right? Whether it's my FX book, that's even not even the best place to go.
No.
We even talked to a couple of proprietary firms, and they look at loads of traders trying to onboard them who say they've got great track records. Mm. They give them a low amount of capital, whether that's 5-10K, and they can't walk the walk.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think, like you say, people are always looking for ways to get around and cheat the system, as opposed to just do the thing in the first place, right? And I guess that comes down to a lot of people are in a poor financial situation and they think trading will fix it. And unfortunately, I say this a lot, trading is not going to fix your financial situation if you're not in the mental capacity to fix it in the first place.
Yeah. Not only that, a lot of people aren't honest with themselves. You can get a long way with an individual sitting down and being completely honest.
Yeah.
And saying, look, listen, this is what I've got. It's not the best. I'm not in a great frame of mind at the minute. I'm not performing as well as I have done in the past, as you can see here, whatever it might be, but I'm willing to give it a go. If it's not for you, it's not for you. If I don't perform well, I don't perform well. It's completely honest. But people come in with completely unrealistic expectations.
We'll know what we can work with.
Yeah.
Being honest and everything's on the table.
And that for me is already a green tick. I don't really give a shit how you perform now, because you've been completely honest with me.
If you're putting up a wall and pretending you're off in the hospital already...
There's a lot of egos in the room, though, right? Yeah. There's a lot of egos where people think, you know, I made a skit ages ago on YouTube, and it was like what a lot of traders do. You know, you'll take a loss, for instance, and because you've got no one really to answer to, you'll have the IR tool up on TradingView. You sort of look around, you're like, no one see that, delete it, move on. And you act like it's not happened, right? But that probably is a very valuable lesson. And if you just looked at your losses, you could learn a lot from them.
Yeah.
But instead, people go, I didn't take that trade in real life. But it's like you did take it, you put it on, and they find a way to make up a reason not to, right?
We spoke about data earlier, and when you're backtesting, how many traders do you think out there, you know, have so many losses when they're trying to build a model and collect data and then just delete it?
Ignore it off.
Why would you delete data that's so important for the model? Mm. Why are you going to take something that doesn't work, pretend it does, and then try and trade it live?
It's ego and not wanting to be wrong, right? A lot of people have got this foundation of they'll find this silver bullet system that won't lose. So when they lose, they're like, oh, I must have not figured it out. And it's like, no, guess what? That just didn't work, mate. It just didn't work in that environment. Yeah. So many things could have been factored in, but if you include it into your data, when you go through the data, perhaps you'll find a nuance and go, oh, maybe I could change or adapt this based on those losses. But instead, everyone has, it's why I suggest that you can be a professional back tester, but you can be a shit trader.
Yeah.
You don't 100%. Have all these results, but if 100%. You can't actually, if they're not legit and then you go live, you get smoked and most traders wonder why. And it's like anyone listening, if you've got good back testing results and it's triggering you, just make sure they're legit, because if they're fake, you're just doing yourself a disservice.
And not only that, I mean, backtesting is fantastic to begin with, but a lot of people don't actually understand what they're doing, like from a backtesting perspective. I'm not talking about like backtesting your system. I'm talking about what is actually backtesting, because and what are the variables that can come into backtesting, like that we talk about overfitting in general. And from a quantitative perspective, there's a theory called overfitting, and there's no real solution for it. However, there's metrics that you can take to basically make sure you're not overfitting, because what a lot of people do is they look at historical performance in a back test and they start making adjustments and making adjustment, whether it be from a parameter perspective or a rule perspective. They start making different changes to better the historical performance. And then what that leads down the road is essentially what you're doing is you're overfitting your strategy to make better historical predictions instead of future predictions. Because all you're realistically doing, because it's a very, very, very fine line from a quantitative perspective, it's a very, very fine line between making a system fitted to historical predictions, to make better historical predictions and better future predictions. Because all we give a shit about is making better future predictions.
Of course, yeah. Of course.
Because when we're looking at historical data and historical like backtesting from theory, a lot of people start making adjustments and parameters to basically better the historical performance, which isn't an issue at all, but it's a very, very fine line between overfitting. And there's a financial concept, there's a quantitative theory that is a scientific theory and has been proven that no rule can be ever approved, it can only be disapproved. Because if you think about it from a logical perspective, if I've got a certain trading rule or a certain strategic parameter, my strategy is in 100% win rate. But just because it lost, does it mean that parameter is failing? Mm. If that rule was approved, then it'd work 100% of the time. No rule can ever be approved. It can only be disapproved. It's scientific theory. Can't argue with that. For me, because the only rule that works is the rule that's working now. So when you're looking at a strategic perspective, if something's underperforming and has met the criteria for me to cut the strategy in general, well, now that rule's been disapproved, or that certain rule's been disapproved. If I'm hitting, if it's fallen, if a certain rule or a certain strategy's fallen out of the parameters that I, out of his expectancy, well, now I need to start making adjustments and start changing the rules. So for me, from a scientific perspective, that makes sense. No rule can ever be approved. It can only be disapproved. That's from quantitative finance.
Just before we finish up, just so people are aware, if people wanted to get in touch with you, if people were looking to perhaps invest, looking to get into, you know, putting money into Westwater, where can people find you? How can people go about that process?
Yeah, so just head over to the westwaterassociates.com website, fill out an inquiry form there, we'll be in touch, and also get in contact with our Twitters, drop us a follow over on there.
I'll put all the links in the description for the guys' website, their Instagrams, their Twitters, you know, you name it, I'll put it in there so you can get in touch. They're also going to be attending the FX Connect event in Birmingham on the 7th. If you're not coming, you should come. It's going to be an incredible day, a lot of value. Hopefully you've taken a lot of value from this conversation. I'm sure there'll be more to come in the future. And yeah, I just want to say a massive thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it. Yeah, thank you.
No worries at all. And yeah, without further ado, I'll catch you on the next one. Peace and love, gang.